guys. I'm K2, Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the tech test for the 1,593rd time. It's a series of meetings of the clan of curious and interested radio amateurs since September of 1982. On Sunday night, this group of people gets together, discusses their favorite subject, ham radio, and how to make it all work better, how to understand it more. There's a lot to be learned about antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and the, I think it's something like 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of them. Add to that things like internet and Echo Link and IRLP, and it just goes on and on. Let me drop it. These people get together in my little introduction, because there's always new people finding the tech net. They want to know what the heck it is. You guys are going to put up with this preamble in which I try to give a brief explanation. We follow a very loose schedule in which the first hour we take questions from people who do have a question or a comment for the net. They sign in giving me their call letters and their name and the word yes, and you do have a question or a comment. Need not sign it just because you're listening. We don't need a list of a long list of people that are listening. After 32.5 years, we believe somebody is listening. This particular net has run for well over 5,000 hours. It may be a record for the number of nets under one, essentially one leadership, although portions of that leadership has changed from time to time. Let me drop it. The first hour of questions and answers is followed by John, KC2WGB, who mans the mailbag, which means people who don't yet have the right ham license or the right equipment so they can talk to us directly, they communicate with John with their question. In fact, we're going to be getting a very interesting question tonight, an extremely progressive amateur wants to build a receiver for cosmic background radiation observation. A lofty goal, and we'll get into some of the details of that. It's not going to be easy, and there's a lot more to the understanding of what goes on there than first meets the eye. That's just one of the many things that will be announced in the mailbag. John also monitors the Echo Link program and also the chat room, so that if we're too quick on the switch and we're not leaving enough gap for all four beeps to take place so that the machine doesn't get properly reset and the person from the outer lands cannot sign into us, then we John knows about it, brings it to our attention, and we eventually let that person get his digit word-wise, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. Now, one of the things that I have to repeat from time to time is that I spend 4 hours every Sunday night manning the tech net. I've done that now for 33 years. That's a reasonable dedication. There are lots and lots of people who listen to me and say, gee, I'm going to write him a letter and he's going to solve my problem. There are lots and lots of people who would like me to give them free consulting service written just by sending me a letter of some form. I am not volunteering to do that. There's a limit. That would go on for ridiculous length of time. Just to give you an example of what I've been subjected to in the past, when I wrote those letters of those articles for QST Magazine on the strip line parallel kilowatt amplifier and the parabolic dish antenna and the antenna ratiometry, around those periods of time when I published those articles, let me drop them, I was getting many hundreds of letters per year in which the person would, in his letter, give me 2 or 3 typed pages of questions, and in between the questions was blank spaces where I was supposed to fill it in. You get a few hundred of those per year. You still realize you're getting overwhelmed. You can't handle it. No matter what you do, there's going to be a lot of people out there mad at you because they didn't get an answer to their letter. They think they're being discriminated against, if you know what I mean. So I make it clear, you cannot get free consulting service from me in writing just by writing to me. Sign into the TechNet Live, where all of us can discuss your particular situation and everybody can benefit from it. So that way we will handle it. Let me drop. After John's mailbag, it's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. Paul will be giving us tonight space report number 192 of the series that began a few years ago. And he'll tell us the latest on what NASA and all the other space agencies are doing. So that gives you a loose schedule of what we're going to do tonight. At this time, we're going to be taking check-ins from people who do have a question or a comment. So please give me your call letters, your name, and the word yes if you do have a question or a comment. K2IW TechNet, we're listening.
W-H-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
We've got Joe. Okay, accepting John, yes, sir. Give me that one again, sir.
W-W-2-S.
Okay, you're saying it extremely low and extremely fast. WW2 blank. Please give me the rest of it a little louder and a little slower. Go ahead.
Whiskey 2 Sierra. How's that?
Whiskey 2 Sierra. And I think you're saying your name is John. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, we heard S. In other words, you talk first and then squeeze the mic. Alrighty. We've got Joe and John. Anyone else to check in? Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Because you do have a question or a comment. Please give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, possibly we're going to have a light night tonight. And maybe that's appropriate because when we do get to the mailbag and we get to the question of cosmic microwave background receiver building and observation, that's a subject that will take some time to get into the details of it. So maybe we'll have that extra time tonight. So Joseph, the P2RYY, how have those electrons been treating you lately? The ones that are supposed to be running back and forth in your antennas that you're building and staying in resonance. How's they been behaving? Over to you, Joe, K2RYW.
I guess the beeps are not programmed correctly tonight. First of all, did you receive my pictures that I sent you? Hopefully so.
I'm so darn forgetful. I probably did. Just tell me, what was it a picture of?
Picture of an antenna tuner circuit. An antenna tuner I just bought. Now that's going to be part of my question, but I have some question related to that.
I think you sent me a schematic diagram. I'm not sure it was a picture itself. A schematic diagram of the tuner. Many tuners are an L network, an LC, an L pi network, a pi L network, and so on. So there's a zillion ways of tuning, and if the person is using equipment where the inductor is beefy enough, and the capacitors have enough range, and the schematic is correct, a antenna tuner can cover a large percentage of the Smith chart. The Smith chart shows all possible impedances that an antenna, for instance, could present. And so, with the right kind of an antenna tuner, you can tune many of those impedances, and even if your particular antenna happens to have an impedance that falls into the bad portion of the Smith chart, there's a corrective procedure for that. There's a zillion guys out there on 20 meters blasting the information that they think is correct, that all reflected power from an antenna that hits an antenna tuner is simply thrown away and wasted. They believe that. They've heard it so often, they've said it so often, it has become a quote truth, unquote, for them. And a high quality antenna tuner, you and I know, Joe, re-reflects all the power forward. None of it gets wasted, except for that amount of power that has to make multiple traverses of your transmission line. If the transmission line has any substantial amount of insertion loss, then yes, you will lose some power. Not because of the tuner, it's because of the transmission line and the high visual of the antenna. A couple of words on that subject, as you can tell. So over to you, Joe. W-H-Y-Y, K2IW TechNet. A good subject, by the way, antenna tuners. Highly misunderstood. As of tonight, in your discussion, we're going to understand them a little bit better. You got it, Joe.
Well, if you could end up being Mr. Wizard, I guess we'll all understand him a little better. I have a sub-question related to this before I ask you the main question related to the antenna tuner. If you measure a return loss of about 1 dB, as far as the way I calculated, and I'm asking a question to see if I'm right or wrong on the answer, that means about 21% is not reflected, and about 79% of your power is reflected. Would you believe that statement to be true?
doing that calculation right now. If the antenna is reflecting 79% of the power, which happens to be 89% of the voltage, you will have a 1 dB reflection coefficient. And with a 1 dB reflection coefficient, you'll have 79% of the power reflected, 21% roughly going out the antenna on the first pass. So a 1 dB reflection coefficient in almost all circumstances represents a very undesirable situation. If this is the best of all worlds, you'd like a minimum reflection coefficient to be 9.5 dB down. That would be a 2-to-1 Dzhuang, half a dB of loss. And if you can get it to be numbers like 15 and 20 dB down, then you're getting into the high 90s of efficiencies and getting into the rather low numbers like 1.5 and 1.3-to-1 standing wave ratio. So what you're confirming, Joe, is that a 1 dB reflection coefficient in most circumstances represents a pretty poorly tuned antenna, and so that's a lot of reflected power, and that's if you're running high power like 100 watts or a kilowatt into that antenna tuner, it's going to be working pretty hard. W2RYY, K2RIW, the tech man.
Okay, let's see, let's let the timer reset. Okay, so I still remember how to do that. Yeah, I know, minus 1 dB is about 79% power, and 2 dB is like minus 2 dB is like 63%. Okay, so I can convert the voltage ratio on that to probably start to understand what kind of VSWR or voltage ratio I'm talking about. Here's my main question. I bought an antenna tuner primarily to be used on a very low frequency, long wire antenna, like on 160 meters. I found from trial and error, first by checking the return loss at the transmitter port of the antenna tuner with an antenna return loss bridge, my service monitor, I wanted to do that first before I put power in it to make sure I wasn't going to, you know, upset the transmitter itself and cause any kind of, you know, issues. And what I found is the antenna tuner only has a range. It says in the paperwork it's supposed to go down to 1.7 megahertz, 1,700 kilohertz. As far as low end, it doesn't go anywhere near there. Not with the antenna I'm presenting as a load to the output, which is on the end of a 50-75 piece of RG213. After that, it's like about 60 feet, 65, 70 feet of wire, just open wire, with no other ground plane radios or anything else attached to it. So it's like, I would consider like an open wire type situation, okay? That's what I read about. That's what I read about 1 dB reflection coefficient on when I look at it on the service monitor, return loss bridge, at about 1850 kilohertz. The antenna tuner will not tune down that low. It goes, I think the low end it goes about 1875, 1880, something like that. So I really want to go down to the low end a bit to make sure I have, you know, usability. The one thing I did notice the antenna tuner, I ran a check at it at a much higher frequency. Once I put the transmitter power into it and verified it, you could take the transmitter. It had about a 30 dB reflection coefficient at, say, 1990 kilohertz. I think, okay, the transmitter be happy with that. It's not going to burn it up or cause any kind of issues. So I put transmitter power into it, let it rip, and it shows no return loss or no VSWR showing on the transmitter supplying the power. I did notice this. The tuning capacitors inside do not get hot, but the inductor inside, which is attached to a step switch, this select different taps on the inductor, that gets very hot, well, moderately warm after a length of time. And I could measure it accurately with my thermal IR meter because the RF would bother if they don't have the transmitter key. It actually made upset the meter. But I could feel with my fingers after letting the thing go that the coil is getting hot. But that's not my main question here. My main question is, I wanted to lower the resonant frequency of the entire antenna tuner to make it be able to work at a much lower frequency. So what I tried to do was put a combination of series and parallel capacitors, series to give me the RF voltage protection, because the caps are using, I think, 82 PF caps at 1 kV. And I want to put a couple of pairs in series and parallel through experimentation. And I got the antenna tuner using the return loss bridge to show me a better reflection coefficient at a much, much lower frequency. Here's the question. The inductor got hot by itself with the antenna tuner stock, but after a length of time of putting power into the antenna tuner, the capacitors, you could see the wax on the thing start to heat up and actually sound like it was sizzling. What's going on? That's my question.
Yeah, that question, Joe, has about three or four different concepts running simultaneously. The manufacturer of your antenna tuner maybe advertises that it goes down to 1800 megs. You went down to 1850, and it would not give you a good match of your particular antenna. There's a catch. Every antenna tuner is being pushed to the limit as far as, is the inductor big enough, are the capacitor, variable capacitors large enough, are the ranges large enough, and so on, when you go down to low frequencies. With most antennas at 1800 megs are not really going to be fully half-wave resonant. People are going to be running things like you are, NSAID, ZIPs, and whatever, that have very high impedances. So the combination of not having big enough components to go down low and antennas that are rather high in standing wave ratio, it's a bad combination as you go down to 1800 megs. Now, the first sub-question, which you didn't ask, but it's really there, was the manufacturer lying when he said it goes down to 1800 megs and you're at 1825 and it doesn't make it? The answer might be he's not lying. Let me drop.
That's kilohertz, not megahertz. 1800 kilohertz.
I said it wrong, but I meant kilohertz, and thank you for correcting me. Every antenna tuner of reasonable design, where you don't have a large number of air variable, high transmitting rated capacitors, and great big inductors, every reasonable antenna tuner, as you go lower and lower in frequency, covers a smaller and smaller area of the Smith chart. For example, there's a higher and higher probability that your particular antenna presents a dot on that Smith chart representing its impedance at, say, 1850 kilohertz, where you're outside of the good region. So it covers some region of the Smith chart, not your particular. So does the antenna tuner work at 1850? Probably. Did it work in your case? Probably not. Your particular antenna has a particular impedance after a certain length of transmission line. The transmission line is a kind of impedance inverter. I can give you a formula where you tell me the length of the transmission line, you tell me the impedance of the antenna at the far end, and I can tell you the exact impedance you're going to see at the near end. And it's a very different place. And that very different place, you could find it on your Smith chart by choosing the dot that represents the impedance of your antenna, putting that dot on the Smith chart, putting your compass, the sharp point of it, in the center of the Smith chart, and swinging a circle with the radius of that dot. And those are all of the possible impedances you will come up with various lengths of transmission line. And the number of degrees of rotation of your compass represents some number of degrees of length of transmission line. So you can bring a bad dot into the good region by adding a length of transmission line. You may decide to do that or not decide to do that. That's one factor. Let me drop. Another factor is you've seen a 1 dB reflection coefficient. Most likely you made that measurement in the shack after the transmission line. And your transmission line has some amount of insertion loss. The real reflection coefficient at the antenna might just be a quarter of a dB. And you got 3/4 dB of forward plus reverse insertion loss of your transmission line at 1850. So the reflection coefficient you measure in the shack is always a little bit optimistic. The real reflection coefficient at the antenna is pretty darn high. And it's higher than what you measured. You probably already know that. Whenever you've got a large amount of reflected power, and now you adjust an antenna tuner so that it can match the situation, a naive person will say, hey, I'm doing an impedance match. Well, there's a lot more going on. Let me drop. All of that power being reflected from the antenna plus transmission line, when the antenna tuner hits the right tuning characteristic, unfortunately, there's more than one solution. Sometimes you can set a different amount of inductance and a different amount of C1 and C2 and hit a tune. There is a desirable tune which gives you the lowest possible Q. There's a whole bunch of undesirable ways of tuning an antenna tuner. We can get a much higher circulating current within the antenna tuner. But the bottom line of all this is that at 1% or 0.5%, 1 dB or 0.5 dB or 0.25 dB of reflected power, almost all your power reflected, is now going to be re-reflected forward. The antenna is only going to accept a small percentage of it on the second pass, the third pass, and so on. So the power is going to be bouncing back and forth a whole lot in the transmission line, giving you a increased loss. But all of those reflections at the antenna tuner also all add up. So you can easily get rather high currents in the inductor, rather high currents in the variable capacitors of the antenna tuner, and it's going to be heating there. Depending on how beefy they are, depending on which particular solution of setting those controls you use, determines how much current, how much heating. In theory, let me drop this. In theory, Joe, you and I have the resources where we could build a coil out of, let me pick a number, quarter-inch diameter copper tubing, and of a reasonable diameter of that coil, so it's got a substantial amount of inductance. And we're going to put it in a great big shielded cage so it doesn't radiate. And we're going to use transmitting-grade capacitors with very good rotary joint contacts on them and large air gaps into these great big plates. So you and I have the resources, Joe, to build an extremely beefy antenna tuner where you could tolerate a half dB reflection coefficient on a really yucky antenna fed with open wire line, and we could put 1,500 watts of peak envelope power, 1,000 watts key down into that beefy antenna tuner, and it would run almost ice cold. So now the quality of an antenna tuner and how compact the components are, how much current it can tolerate, how hot it's going to get, these are the variables you're now running into. And by way of your fingers detecting heat, you're detecting real fast what percentage of the power is being wasted in the antenna tuner. And in most cases, you'd be amazed how small that is. If the antenna tuner is wasting 10 watts of the 100 watts you want to put into the antenna, let me drop it. 10 watts out of 100 watts, that's a half a dB of loss or so. So if the antenna tuner is giving you half a dB of insertion loss, which you and I wouldn't lose a whole lot of sleep over that, but 10 watts of dissipation for a key down period of 10 minutes, if there isn't a blower on that antenna tuner, some of those components inside can get very hot to the fingers and really alarm the daylights out of you. So now we've got to be a little bit more quantitative as to finding out how much heat we measured over what period of time, with how many watts input, how many watts of power is that really dissipating, what percentage of my transmitter power I want to go to the antenna is that wasting, and should I be alarmed and make modifications to the design, or should I say, hey, that's not significant, I'm going to work on other things like the antenna itself. So that's some of the information I think you're looking for. So as you can tell, interpreting an antenna tuner's operation, should it get hot? Did it get too hot? Should it get hot in this situation? Should it impedance match this particular situation? As you can see, Joe, there's quite a few variables involved. The second half of your question, which I'm now being forgetful, I don't even remember, but maybe some of this information is helpful. The B2RYY, good set of questions on an area that's highly misunderstood. KQRIW in the TechNet. You've got it, Joe.
Well, after we're done talking about this, I'll tell you what I did as far as measuring the radiation of the antenna as far as path loss to another antenna using a signal generator. That's another part of this. But anyway, because it sort of does prove your theory, what you said about the antenna tuner, what it does. But I'll get into that a little later. But my main question is, the capacitors are getting very hot, the extra add-ons I put on. Is it because of too much current going through them? And number two, can I find certain types of capacitors I can use in a series parallel combination to give me to be high enough with voltage breakdown consideration and not get bothered by the current going through them? Obviously, the air variable cap is of whatever rating. I think it's maybe one of my, I think they tell you the paperwork might be like 500 PF maximum. See, I'm getting to a point where the antenna, the capacitor, the tunable capacitors are both fully meshed, and I can't get below, I think the lowest I can really resolve with the antenna is about 1875 kilohertz. Can't really go below that. I just can't resolve it without some extra help. I can't take the coil out of the thing because the coil is a certain physical size and there's a ballon in front of the coil, so I can't put a bigger coil in there lengthwise or diameter-wise. The only thing I thought of I could possibly do is maybe give the capacitors, the tunable ones, a little bit of help by increasing the capacity totally across that circuit, but maybe I'm going about it the wrong way.
Maybe you're going going about it the right way, Joe. Where your variable capacitors, or at least one of them, if not both of them, are fully meshed, implying they want more capacitance to hit the tuning that you're trying to accomplish. And now you put fixed capacitors in parallel with that in order to bring them into range. You're doing the right thing, but there's a catch. There's something in the old world called transmitting rated fixed capacitors. They usually were mica. Every real capacitor has a equivalent series resistance. Sometimes that equivalent series resistance is literally made out of the wire going into the capacitor being too fine. That's less likely. More likely, the equivalent series resistance really represents loss tangent of the dielectric material. You use, for instance, a fixed watt-type capacitor, which at low power levels going into a coupling capacitor between the grid and the plate of a circuit would work like a charm. But you try to put transmitting power through a watt capacitor, for instance, the loss tangent of that dielectric might be only a couple of percent. But because of the amount of reflected power going back and forth between your capacitors and that inductor, in order to try to hit the, let me pick a number, Q of 10 or Q of 100 ratio of the antenna tuning, of the antenna tuner, you now can have some pretty fierce amounts of voltage and current going through that capacitor. If it was a transmitting rated fixed capacitor, like the ones made out of mica, where the mica as a dielectric has got a very low loss tangent, therefore, you can have a capacitor made with mica, transmitting grade rated, where you can put 100 amperes through it at 1,825, 1,850 kilohertz, and it will run ice cold. You do that with a certain kind of wax capacitor, and you'll melt it down. Let me drop a quick. So there are capacitors and there are capacitors. Most air variable capacitors are reasonably high in rating. Simply because air is a very low dielectric, a very low loss tangent material. So if you had the ability to pick up some other air variable capacitors you've got and put them in parallel, that would solve the problem. If you can get a hold of some transmitting grade rated mica capacitors, they were popular in the 50s, they've become very unpopular today. In the very early days of Lafayette Radio, you could walk into their store and say, I want a 500 picofarad transmitting rated tantalum capacitor with a 5,000 volt rating, and there's a 50-50 chance they reach onto the shelf and hand it to you. You go into Radio Shack today and they'll say, what language are you speaking? What planet did you come from? So the pot has become unpopular today and is not being stocked. However, the good thing about the internet, you use the right search, you'll find that capacitor. So when it comes to increasing your caps, you either buy the right transmitting grade mica type capacitors or use air variable capacitors or find another substitution. There's a way you can put an extremely high rated capacitor in that circuit. Let me drop.
By the vacuum variable.
There's a cheaper way he can do it. He can take a good length of RG8 coax cable, particularly or that's got polyethylene. If he chooses one that's got Teflon, he can build a stub, a capacitive stub that he installs. And the nice thing about transmission line being used as a capacitor, less than a quarter wavelength long if it's an open circuit, more than a quarter wave long if it's a short circuit, but you can synthesize a monstrous capacitor with a stub of coaxial cable that can tolerate a whole lot of power. The vacuum variable is a great way to go if Joe is willing to spend a whole lot of money. If Joe's like me, he's going to be a little bit reluctant to... His hand's going to shake before he signs that particular check. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, T-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Hey, so, I guess as you'd put it, right church, wrong pew. Okay. How about silver mica capacitors? Would that type of capacitor work?
Maybe yes, maybe no. How beefy is it? Transmitting rated capacitors, back in the days when they were being sold, they usually were in rectangular packages. You could tell right away that something was funny about them. The capacitor might say 200 picofarad on it, and it has the volume 10 times greater than an ordinary 200 picofarad capacitor. Transmitting rated capacitors are physically large, usually have mica as the dielectric constant, and so by various techniques, you have the ability, if you had a Q meter, and there's ways you can homebrew a Q meter, by way via the homebrew Q meter, you can literally measure the equivalent series resistance of the capacitor that you don't know anything about. You can measure the equivalent series resistance by putting it into a Q measuring circuit, putting some amount of power through it, and measure what its phase angle is, if you know what I mean. If the capacitor was perfect, all current you put into it at 1850 kilohertz will be exactly 90 degrees of phase shift. And if the phase shift of the current you put into a capacitor is 85 degrees, there's ways you can calculate what loss tangent that represents, what percentage of the power you're putting into it is being turned into heat. So there's ways you can make this measurement of an unknown capacitor to find out if it'll solve your problem, Joe. I didn't say it's easy. I'm just telling you there is light at the end of that particular tunnel. Over to you, Joe. K2LIW.
Alright, so I should start looking for transmitting rated mica capacitors, not silver mica, correct?
I didn't say that. Silver mica might do it. Now, you're sort of indirectly asking me whether ever any transmitting grade capacitors that were made with silver mica. The answer probably is yes. Your particular silver mica capacitor, is it beefy enough, low enough in equivalent series resistance, close enough to exactly 90 degrees of phase shift when you put 1850 kilohertz into it, does your particular capacitor meet all of your requirements? That's going to take some further investigating or measurements, Joe. So we can't necessarily say all silver micas are good, all silver micas are bad, all mica capacitors are good for transmitting grade. So there's a few more variables here. Not all blondes are the best lady we should marry. Thank you, Joe. K2LAW.
Okay, well, I'll have to explore that and then maybe do it on buying a couple of caps and see if I can, heat-wise, if they're gonna work. That's right, mainly fine. I don't want to wreck the capacitors. Here's what I did with the, through the experimentation. Being that I've never had an antenna tuner before to actually sort of play with and sort of prove your theory, and it sort of worked out like this. I took my cyclone generator. I had the output set to about minus 5 dBm. I don't want to run it up all the way, all the way. And since it can work duplex, I can send and receive it on the same unit. I looked at it at the signal on another antenna elsewhere on my house, and I saw the signal arrive at the other antenna at minus 58. Okay, and I figured, well, that's probably my path loss, give or take 50, 52 dB, something like 54 dB, whatever, between antenna 1, which is my long wire antenna, and antenna 2, which is your receiving antenna. Now I took the antenna 2 and took 19.
Is your question, why is the apparent insertion loss in free space between the transmitter? transmitting antenna and the receiving antenna. Why did it change? Why did it change when you did and didn't use the antenna tuner as opposed to the transmitter with a 40 dB pad? Rephrase the question, Joe, go ahead.
It wasn't really meant as a question. It really should be meant as a comment, per se. The signal out of my HF transceiver was set for 1 watt. Service mono set for 40 dB, input attenuation on the input to the antenna for the spectrum analyzer. Okay? Signal I observed when I transmit into the wire antenna with no antenna tuner, I observed on the spectrum analyzer at minus 62. So if you subtract 40 dB from that, that would be about minus 22, and that would probably seem to almost account for the path loss between the 1 watt going in and the signal I received off another antenna elsewhere in the house, okay? And I'm also using, you know, double shielded lines, at least coming and going off my service monitor to keep those as shielded as best as possible. As I said, I put the antenna tuner in, and now I observe my input signal going up to about minus 57, so it increased about almost 5 dB. That's without touching the antenna tuner and having it preset to have the best return loss at 1990 kilohertz. Now I touched up the tuning of the antenna tuner very slightly and noticed my signal arriving at the spectrum analyzer went up about 1.5 dB. It's sort of just an observation more than anything else, but that seems to be, if you look at it, from the original signal I received without the antenna tuner compared to what I have it with the antenna tuner in and adjusted properly as to match the transmitter, they're giving an increase of about 6.5 decibels.
Now, when you tried to transmit exactly 1 watt out of your transmitter, 1 watt into a dummy load, rather easy to set. If you've now got, say for instance, a Bird wattmeter in series with your transmitter, when you're going directly to your antenna without an antenna tuner, in that particular situation, with the antenna, with the transmitter directly to the antenna without an antenna tuner, how did you set the transmitter for 1 watt at that time, Joe? Go ahead.
I set the transmitter into a 50 ohm dummy load, basically the input of the service monitor on the TXRX4, and I set it for 1 watt and left that power adjustment alone. I did not touch that power adjustment later when I put the transmitter directly going into the low wire antenna without the antenna tuner. So, yes, there's a big mismatch. You can see that on the front panel display that the reflected power was right up to the top, but I don't think the transmitter folds back at that lower power level. Higher power levels, it will fold back. It actually folds back when it goes to about 2-to-1 VSWR on the indicated on the transmitter screen on the display. It'll fold back to like 50 watts or so, but I don't think at a very low power level going forward if it actually folds back or not. I could be wrong on that.
Okay. I'm not worried about foldback at the 1 watt level. Any reasonable transmitter folds back at a particular amount of reflected power, maybe 25 watts. 1 watt, no. However, there's a big catch here. If you used rather elaborate instrumentation and you looked back into your transmitter when it's transmitting 1 watt, you assume you're going to see a 50 ohm source of signal. Not even close. My guess is the output stage of your transmitter, even if it's solid state, even if it's a tetro tube, doesn't matter. It's extremely close to a constant current generator. It's equivalent impedance. It's almost an open circuit. If you look back into that transmitter, you're going to see something like, I'm going to pick a number, a 1200 ohm source resistance in series with a huge amount of capacitance. Your transmitter produces rated performance in intermodulation distortion and power output and linearity when it's loaded with 50 ohms. It is designed for a 50 ohm load. It is not a 50 ohm source. As such, when you connect your transmitter to a dummy load where it sees 50 ohms and set it for exactly 1 watt of output, then you connect it to some really wild impedance like your antenna on an 1850 might be, the actual power your transmitter is producing could be higher or lower. It could be hugely lower. And even if you use the Bird wattmeter in series between transmitter and antenna and try to figure out how many watts it's generating, because such a huge amount of power from your unmatched antenna, no antenna tuner, is being reflected and then coming back to the transmitter, which the output stage of the transmitter, let me drop. The output stage of the transmitter really is a nearly open circuit. Therefore, it cannot absorb. It can get all kinds of grief of excess voltages and arc over and all kinds of nasty things can happen to the final stage. But it cannot absorb reflected power. It gets re-reflected forward. So how much power is the transmitter really producing? Even if you did put a watt meter there between it and the antenna, is subject to a whole lot of interpretation. So the transmitter really is producing an entirely different power, very different than 1 watt. Higher or lower, I don't know. Most likely lower when it's going into the real antenna. On top of that, when you now put an antenna tuner there, and now you've got a good match, that's a good news, and you assume the transmitter is going to produce maximum power into that situation. Not necessarily. Because of the crazy way a transmitter works, when you readjust the antenna tuner, not for the best match, but for the best power output, you may find out that your particular transmitter likes seeing a 150-ohm resistive load with a little bit of inductance, and that's where it produces maximum power output when it's set at the 1-watt level. And when you adjust the controls on your antenna tuner to hit that magic number, maybe your transmitter that previously had been adjusted for 1-watt output into a dummy load is now making it 1.5 watts. So there's a lot of variables involved here. We all assume that our transmitter is a 50-ohm source. None of them are. If you put a 30 dB attenuator after it, yeah, it's damn close to a 50-ohm source. But you look back into that tetrode tube, or into that FET transistor, or into that bipolar transistor, it's nearly a constant current generator, very far from 50 ohms. Rated performance when it sees 50 ohms as a load, but it ain't a 50 ohm source. Ain't that crazy, Joe? W2LYY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, my transmitter's TS690, so it's a solid-state transmitter. Go ahead, Eric.
I just wanted to point out that most solid-state transmitters with parallel the transistors in parallel, and they'll typically be 100-ohm resistor between them, looking somewhat like a Wilkinson divider backwards. So the impedance tends to be on the high side of most solid-state transmitters. Tubes is a whole other story. But you'll find that a lot of the transmitters, even when you're transmitting 1 watt, you said you had a baton loss of about 1 dB. If you stick that into there, you've got to figure that's a little over a 15 to 1 vis loss. So that much energy coming back will actually flip the diodes and cause the thing to fold back a little bit. And by the way, at that frequency, you can hook an oscilloscope to it and measure the voltage and do your calculations that way.
You just brought up a very interesting point, Eric, and that is if there's two transistors in the final and they're being used with something like a Wilkinson half hybrid as a power summing device with a 100-ohm resistor between them, that gives you nice isolation between those two transistors, and the two powers add very nicely. Had the manufacturer gone one step further, had he used a quadrature hybrid to sum the two powers, and use 90 degrees of phase shift in the way you drive those two transistors, instead of a Wilkinson. A Wilkinson is a 0-degree hybrid. Had they used a 90-degree hybrid, a quadrature hybrid, and 90 degrees of phase shift between the drive of the two transistors, you're now building something called a Cura Power Amplifier. He won a whole lot of awards for doing that, Mr. Cura Power. And the nice thing about that, that's the one place in the world where the output of impedance of each individual transistor could be a perfect open circuit, constant current generator. But because of that quadrature hybrid operation and its 50-ohm dummy load that's on this fourth port, you look back into that transmitter, you'll see a perfect 50-ohm source. And if you use the quadrature hybrid to feed the input of those two grids of those two tubes, if you know what I mean, even though they're almost an open circuit, again, the quadrature hybrid will give you a perfect 50-ohm impedance. So if you're smart enough, to use a quadrature hybrid feeding the two power devices, like transistors, and the quadrature hybrid to gather the two powers output, that's the one place in the world where, as long as your two transistors are reasonably matched, they can have input impedance that are crazy as all hell, output impedance that are crazy as all hell, but because of the double use of a quadrature hybrid, input and output, in the so-called Kurokawa amplifier, you're now, for the first time in the world, see a perfect 50-ohm input and a perfect 50-ohm output and great operation. It's very little extra cost to do that. and the manufacturer had been smart enough, boy, he could make an awful lot of these crazy characteristics we measure go away. I wonder if you've ever heard of that one, Eric. K2EJ, K2IW, the TechNet.
K2IW, K2EJ. You'll find that actually in most of the commercial repeaters on VHF. Not typically on UHF, but you'll find them on VHF. There'll be a quadrature hybrid at the input that drives the input of the transistors, and a quadrature hybrid at the output to recombine it. And you'll see a lot of that in commercial stuff, but you won't find it in something that tunes, 30 or 40 megahertz.
Hold on now. Those quadrature hybrids, there's ways of building those very broadband. So there are kinds of killer tower amplifiers that are simultaneous, a very good impedance match, and some of them, if you use zingers, for instance, as quadrature hybrids, you can cover very close to an octave of frequency range. So, yeah, there are ways of building a quadrature hybrid, like a branch coupler, which happen to be rather narrow band, but there are ways of building one very broadband. K2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I'm totally aware of that, but that's just typically what the commercial guys do. Actually, in one of my TV transmitters, I use a whole slew of them. But, that's only dealing with 6 megahertz, so it's a little cheaper than making something that's really broadband. Not by much, but that's what they do. Well, there's a lot of things you can do. I'm heading out east, so I probably should switch over in a minute. K2RIWK to adjust.
Hey, you're sounding real good on the input. In the case of the broadcast world, where broadcast transmitters need real good control of intermodulation distortion, group delay distortion, you would like the impedance to be purely 50 ohms across your whole 6 megs of bandwidth at both the input and the output in order to control any triple transit of the antenna and so on. Ghosting effects back in the AM days, and now ghosting effects today can give you inter-symbol distortion, so you'd like to not have it. So you guys are very impedance sensitive. In the case of VHF commercial transmitters that are using quadrature hybrids, I think their motivation is to make sure you've got stability. A bipolar transistor at a VHF frequency, where the Don transistor has got UHF gain capability, or he's just sitting there ready to take off an oscillator, whatever his favorite frequency is. You put the right kind of terminated quadrature hybrid on the input and the output of a pair of those transistors, and an unstable amplifier can suddenly become very stable and be very happy to use. So, as you can tell, Joe, there are all kinds of transmitters that we can lay our hands on, all kinds of ways of doing it. But you tell the average amateur that his transmitter is not a 50-ohm output impedance, and he'll say, what the hell are you talking about? The B2LYY, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Well, I thought something was a good question to bring up as a subject, because it probably interests everybody, including you.
Yep. Trying to set the power output of a non-50-ohm transmitter into a non-50-ohm antenna with some random length of transmission line between the two, and you think you're defining the true amount of forward power being generated in that highly reflective environment where the real power is bouncing back and forth in that transmission line, and you try to say, I am generating 1 watt of power right now. Oh boy, that's a tall order. When you've got a mismatched source, a mismatched load, and a length of transmission line between the two, that's changing the impedances. So, interesting set of experiments you're involved in, Joe. And, Joe, what's the next step in your procedure here to get down to the truth? You're taking off your shoes, and you're trying to get down to the bedrock. What's the next step you're about to take, Joe? W-J-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W, and the TechNet.
Very simple. I'm going to find capacitors one way or the other that I can put across those air variable caps, lower the resonant frequencies to make the thing tune to the frequency I would like it to tune to, which is preferably I want it to go down to at least 1800 and be rated totally usable down to 1800. And not that I want to use it down there immediately, but I want the thing to have the entire range of the 160 meter band. That's my ultimate goal of this whole experiment. So I will find caps that I can put across these air variable caps that will not sizzle when I transfer 100 watts into them. That's my goal.
Yep, and at the 100 watt level and above, you got to be a little bit careful in choosing those capacitors. I think of the capacitors available to you and I today, and doubt that 1% of them really are transmitting grade low enough in loss tangent, low enough in equivalent series resistance, high enough in power rating, high enough in voltage rating, that are going to give you good operation in your circumstance. You've got to be rather careful in choosing those capacitors. It exists. And there's ways you can homebrew that capacitor so that it's transmitting grade and high in performance. And it's going to be slightly voluminous. So one way or another, you're going to get those capacitors. You just got to be a little bit careful. Just digging into your dump junk box and picking up a capacitor of the right number of picofarads, that's not the solution, as you can tell. There's more to this when it first meets the eye. You're into some relatively high-level physics, high-energy physics by amateur radio standards. Good luck with that project, Joe, and let us know what you find. WW2S, John from Massapequa. So, what's new with you, John? Over to you, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, stand by, Eric. Let's see if John is there first. WW2S, K2RIW. Go ahead, John, and give us some more audio, John. You're speaking very softly. I don't know what change you've made, John. I'm hearing you on the input, but you're not coming through the machine. You've either turned off the PO, tone, or moved your antenna, or moved your position. So I'm hearing you on the input, but I'm not hearing you coming through the machine. WW2S, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, while John is changing his settings, Eric, you wanted to make a comment. K2EJ, K2RIW, go ahead, Eric.
The question is, such high current. One of the things that I do is I take a sheet of Teflon and some aluminum and literally make it passive because you need to, now that those frequencies probably need somewhat of a large value. What I did is to screen capacitors for now, but to, it's a pretty simple procedure and it'll handle an awful lot of current.
You're absolutely right, Eric. Two sheets of aluminum with a sheet of Teflon in between the two, and they're held together by way of either nylon screws or metal screws with nylon bushings to make sure you're not shorting things out. You can develop easily 1,000 picofarad, many thousands of picofarad, depending on area, and it's calculatable. 0.225 A over T. In other words, you take the area in square inches and the thickness of the dielectric in inches, 0.225 A over T, that tells you the capacitance you're going to get in picofarads. And because your dielectric constant of your material, Teflon for instance, has I think a 2.5 to 1, you take that capacitance rating for air that I just gave you of that formula, 0.225 A over T, and multiply it by 2.5 because of your Teflon dielectric. And as long as your Teflon is virgin Teflon, not reused Teflon, which has got pinholes in it, you can easily make a capacitor of thousands of picofarads, tolerating thousands of volts, having an extremely low equivalent series resistance, and not taking very much area. There are guys who have built plate tuning, plate B plus bypass capacitors for amplifiers by that technique. In other words, a sheet of Teflon on the inside of the cabinet with a sheet of aluminum against it, right up, acting as the feed through capacitor, giving you the 2,000 volts going into the amplifier. Let me drop. That simple circuit, properly built, can be an extremely low inductance, extremely high shielding characteristic, feed through bypass capacitor. That can be considerably better than the best filter con you could be installing in that location in order to make sure that none of the RF energy inside your amplifier gets out on the B-plus lead going back to the 2,000-volt power supply. So, homebrew capacitors. We amateurs nowadays don't even consider it. Back in the 40s and 50s and 60s, where you couldn't get your hands on the right kind of capacitors without spending a boodle of money, and amateurs in those days homebrewed them. And so, it's a lost art. And Eric is bringing to our attention, it doesn't have to be a lost art. It's not a black art. It's not rocket science. You can do it. And measuring the amount of capacitance, if you have any doubt as to the amount of capacitance you've just created, you want to, as a bypass capacitor, let me drop it. Procedure note, Dick. As a your bypass capacitor, you want it to be above some number to get enough bypassing. And to make sure it's not arcing over, that's easy. And to measure the capacitance in picofarads, believe it or not, you can easily do that with modern day digital voltmeters and vacuum tube voltmeters. You can measure that capacitance with a 60 cycle sine wave coming out of a 6.3 volt filament transformer. You can measure that amount of capacitance. You'd be amazed how easy it is. And so if you worry about the capacitor being different at 3.5 megacycles versus 60 hertz, don't worry about it. John's got some further words on this. KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. No, just a procedural note, Dick. The time has not been reset, so we're not having the four beeps. We only have the one beep, and it's not enough time for old resets. Getting some complaints in the chat room on timeout. So if you could just hold a couple of seconds longer. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Fix that in a couple of minutes.
Yeah. When it's 9 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, the clock that hasn't yet been reset at the repeater, is my guess, still thinks it's 7 o'clock, so to speak. Therefore, it hasn't gone into the four beep mode. Okay, so we're going to leave greater amounts of time in here. Let me see if the machine is... Okay, we still got... Oh, the amount of delay I've got out there to the 375 machine. Now, that's just amazing, Eric. Huge amount of delay. What the hell is going on there? That's because of multiple resets. KE2EJ, K2RIW, the TechNet.
That's going to the IRLP. That's what the delay is from.
That's exactly right, and that's what I'm on my way to take care of, amongst other things.
Yeah, give us some words on that, Eric. Did it flip over to the IRLP mode because of timeout, because of a computer glitch, because of change in daylight saving time? Roughly what got us into this situation, Eric? KE2EJ with some delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Actually, the reason for it is because of construction and reconstruction, cables, pins breaking, stuff like that, because there was a problem a couple weeks ago, and went to take care of it, and the thing has been changed so many times that its integrity is just like, forget it. So I made up a nice new cable, I'm going to plug that in, that'll solve that problem.
Okay, I am guessing you're coming into the eastern input, because I heard an entirely different delay. I was hearing you going into that input. So that's amazing. When you go into the eastern input, what comes out of the western machine has almost no delay. Right now, I'm going into the western machine, and what comes out of the eastern machine has a huge amount of delay. How come there's a different amount of delay in the two different directions? I guess there's two different paths by which the audio is getting there. Is that roughly it, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, as you know, the internet is a bi-directional type of thing that can follow many different paths. And depending upon which path is making a connection in one direction, it doesn't necessarily have to be the same path in the opposite direction. There's also, the delay itself is from the codecs, along with the propagation delay through the network itself. So it's a combination of ingredients.
Yes.
One of the things that I've noticed, Eric, is that when we're going through internet interconnections, as time goes on, the amount of delay seems to build up longer and longer. Maybe it's just my impression. I know somebody said test. We'll get to you in a second. So, Eric, I've seen the internet connections, the delay getting longer and longer. Is that just my perception, or is that really what's going on? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
All right, I can give you the specifics of this particular connection, which is about to change in a couple of minutes. We currently use a DSL modem at Selden, at the eastern input, that is more than 15,000 feet from the switching office. So there's a lot of what you call retransmission of packets, where it makes an error, it does an ARQ, it requests a netter copy of the packet, and that builds up in a buffer, and over time that buffer gets longer and longer.
Interesting. Out of curiosity, Eric, once you know that that buffer building up longer and longer is